welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm Troy Sinek, here with the classicist himself, Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Elia Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, today we take one of our occasional trips around the world, inspired by a piece that you recently wrote for National Review on the major foreign policy challenges facing the U.S. and how the Trump administration is dealing with them. And this piece really focuses on three countries. And so the best way for us to start is probably just to take each of those three in turn. And I want to begin with the one that has probably been most central to the administration, which, of course, is China. And the break the Trump administration has made here is probably sharper than the one with the other two countries we're going to discuss, because pretty much every post-Cold War president prior to Trump seemed to see their responsibility vis-a-vis China as sort of gently coaxing them into playing nice with the rest of the world. I know that you regard that as a mistake. So walk us through how you view the present situation with China and what you make of the Trump administration's response thus far.
Well, three things. The status quo, or the bipartisan consensus, the rules-based order, whatever the bureaucrat tease is, was that China had 1.3 billion people. It was now engaged in a hyper-capitalistic market agenda. It was going to take over the world's hegemony in 20, 30 years. Nothing you could really do about it. So you want to offer them concessions. You don't want to polarize them and bring them into the world community, and they would finally reform as they got wealthier. Nobody believes that anymore. So Trump came in and said, we'll go broke or we'll be dead before that happens. And the problem that I see that Trump has, and which I alluded to in the article, was everything that makes China what it is today was based on running up huge trade deficits, stealing technology, patent and copyright infringement, dumping product below the market cost or the cost of production, and currency manipulation. And to roll all of that back, and what's what Trump is trying to do through tariffs, is really to say to the Chinese, you're not going to be where you thought you were, because all of your present wealth, a lot of it is based, I shouldn't say all, but a lot of it's based on cheating and mercantilism, and we're going to stop it. And then the China would have to say, okay, go ahead and stop it. We're sorry. We got wealthy on the backs of other people, and we're not going to do it anymore. I just don't think that's going to happen. So where we are is that as China gets poorer and it has social tensions, and you can see it in Hong Kong, at some point we've got to decide how we're going to manage this asymmetry, because we're winning and our economy is booming and China's is not right now. And everybody said Trump, the tariffs wouldn't work and couldn't do this, couldn't do that. But I think the problem right now is Trump's got to decide whether you want to have an abject victory over China and then go back to square one and make it behave, you know, like France or Britain, or you want to cut a deal before the election and then say to people, well, they were running up a $600 billion trade deficit, they're $300 billion, and they're not stealing so much copyright and patents and things like that, because it's going to be very hard. It's an existential fight, and China knows that cheating, is what we call cheating, was essential to their success.
Next up on your list in the piece is Iran. Barack Obama expended a lot of effort in his second term into getting to a deal with Iran. President Trump, of course, has walked away from that. And yet many of the people who agreed with the president on that have subsequently been somewhat critical of him for not being forceful enough in the time since he walked away, especially when we had that wave of Iranian provocations towards the U.S., towards Britain, towards Saudi Arabia. How well do you think the administration has calibrated its response, and how do you think of the danger with Tehran?
I think it's done pretty well, but it has a paradox, because he ran by tweaking the Republican establishment's foreign policy by saying, you people in the swing states of the Midwest, I'm not going to send your kids over for optional military engagements. Okay, but we can all agree you don't want to go bomb Libya or go into Iraq again. But what about deterrence when somebody does something? So he said he bombed the crap out of ISIS. Everybody was for that. And so when Iran starts to go broke, and they're going broke because these sanctions are not like any sanctions even that Obama placed on them. They're really tough. I think their oil production's down by 90%, the amount of oil they can sell. And so at some point, what's the end game? The end game is regime change, and when a million people go out in the street like they did in 2009, and they seem to be doing now, then you support them, you give them your moral and spiritual support, and then Iran, what, collapses? I hope so, but we don't know the degree to which it has enriched uranium. We don't know and how quickly they can convert it into a missile. We don't know how you're going to maintain deterrence when you don't reply to a provocation, because you don't want to be bogged down in the Middle East, or you don't want your base to bolt before the election. And so he's trying to thread that needle. I think what he's saying is, if they shoot down a drone, we're not, no big deal, and nobody likes the Saudis, so we don't like them blowing up a refinery, but you know what, nobody wants to die for Saudi Arabia. But if they hijack a boat or they attack an American, then they're going to have to figure out a way to restore deterrence, and that would probably be disproportionate bombing. So if they send a missile that hits a frigate, then we would take out an entire military base or their whole air force, but not put troops on the ground. And that's where we are. It's analogous to China, as I try to point out, because it's working. And Iran knows now that we're on to them, and they were cheating, and the Iran deal was a flawed arrangement in their favor, and that's not going to happen again. And it would be humiliating for them to back down now and take a new deal. And yet they have to, or they're going to go absolutely broke or face a revolution. So in that, you know, between a rock and a hard place, something's going to happen, and it's not going to be necessarily peaceful. So we got to be really prepared for it.
Final one on your list here is North Korea. And again, this is one, Victor, where a lot of people who like the president, and a lot of people who broadly share your views on foreign policy, think that the president has perhaps been too eager to please here, that he's given Kim Jong-un a lot of good PR, that he's maybe seemed too eager to make a deal. How much credence do you give to those kinds of complaints?
And they need to read those ghostwritten series, Art of the Deal, Art of the Comeback, because he's doing exactly on script what he talked about. And that is, you act like you're crazy. You demand twice what you need. You get 55% of what you want, or you think you're going to get, and you never insult your interlocutor, and you praise him to high heaven as a genius. So he came into office. They had 6 to 8 missiles, supposedly, that were pointed at the West Coast that maybe had inter-ballistic missile nuclear capability. So he said, my button's bigger than yours, and it works. And he sounded little rocket man and all that. Everybody was paranoid. They hated him. And then he went over there and praised Kim Jong-un and supposedly got a deal. Well, the deal was that they're not going to get nuclear weapons. And so they thought they could do what they did under the six-party agreement and the agreed-on framework with Bush and Clinton, and that is lie and just say, oh, all our people are dying. They're eating grass. This is so horrible. Stop the sanctions, and we'll agree to everything you want. And so we always did, and then they went right back at it. And I think with Trump now, I don't see there's a downside. And by this, I mean we're not eating grass in the United States, and they're cut off from energy and food and everything, and it's getting worse and worse there, and we can wait forever. And our allies are behind us, and China is a patron. It's not doing so well. So what Trump is trying to do is say to them, hey, we like you. Who? I don't know who did the sanctions. I guess we did. And I know they're tough. You know, everybody used to let them go. I don't think we're going to stop them, but we love you guys. And then his critics go, wow, did you hear what he said about this dictator? Well, that's the way he does it. And it's, again, it shares the same level of risk as North Korea and China, because I'm not sure Trump has an out. And by that, I mean, when they get really desperate and they're starving, and Trump is a mass murderer in the media, and they're going to ask to lighten or reduce some of the sanctions, or that North Korea starts sending live missiles into the South China Sea or something, what are you going to do then? And he's got to be prepared for that. There is a deal to get out of it. It just says the whole peninsula is not, is has no nuclear weapons. It's nuclear free, and we, nobody's going to go across the 38th parallel to depose you. And that's, and the reason they're not going to do that is because they say, does that include if we have an internal revolt or an implosion in, you know what I mean, we like the Soviet Union, then what are you going to do? And so that's what they're afraid of.
So a big change in any one of those three countries would obviously, it'd have a huge impact. And one loves to, as you said with Iran, imagine a scenario in which any one of them is effectively defanged and put on a less threatening course. And it could also, of course, cut the other way. One of these places could get extremely volatile. This could be sort of potentially destabilizing. So run the risk analysis here for us, Victor. If you were trying to project probabilities between China, Iran, and North Korea, which strikes you as the place most likely for change to come first, and which strikes you as the one where we could see the most chaos accompanying change?
I think China is the least chaotic, and by that I mean it's got so much to lose economically, and it's been so successful that it feels, and it knows it's cheated to such a degree that if it were to cut back some, it would, it could say to its people, hey, we took these crazy Westerners, the cleaners, for 20 years, and they only now woke up, and we still got a pretty good deal, so we got to give up something because we're wealthy now, and we're the main player. So I think they're going to find rationalizations. The more dangerous are Iran, and I think especially Iran, because Iran was given this infusion of cash under Obama, and they were bankrolling Hezbollah. They were buying all these missiles. They were riding high, $400 million in cash at night, hostages, all that stuff. And now it's not there. And they thought the Europeans hate Trump so much that they would jump on. But now they're afraid that the sanctions could hurt them if they did, if they try to break them. So what's Iran looking at? There's nothing there for them. And they're getting poorer and poorer and poorer, and the government's getting more and more illegitimate. And first it's a drone, and then it's taking out a Saudi refinery. And I think the next step will be trying to egg on the Israelis to do something in Syria, or to take out a NATO ship or a ship in the Straits of Hormuz. And in other words, they're trying to calibrate exactly where they can humiliate Trump, but not to a degree that righteous indignation and anger in America will justify a terrible retaliation. And then his base is Jacksonian. By that I mean it's tit for tat and bomb the crap out of them, and they're not worth one American life. And that's not necessarily as Iranians understand it. They think, well, he doesn't want to go and have an Iraq. People didn't like Iraq, not because we were punishing the Iraqis. They didn't like it. It's because they felt that these people weren't worth it. I'm not saying I agree or disagree, but the people of Pennsylvania and Indiana and Ohio, North Carolina and Michigan have no problem with taking out an entire Iranian refinery as long as you don't set foot in Iran. So I don't think they understand that, that there's a way that Trump can retaliate and deter them without alienating his base before the election. But that's a windy way of saying they're going to try something before the election, I think. And they think they're going to get a better deal with a Democratic president. So
the final thing that I'll ask you, the cliche in international affairs is that oftentimes the threat you need to most worry about is the one that you're not presently worrying about. So let's just take, for the sake of discussion, these three pieces off the board. We just bracket China, Iran, and North Korea for a moment. President Trump in a second term, or any potential successor for President Trump, what's the hot spot in the world that they need to keep their eye on despite the attention they have to pay to the three?
Well, I think it's Turkey, because they've got this S-400 missile system from Russia, and they're already trying it out with NATO weapons, F-16s. And when they get the F-35, which I think they have eight companies that are participating in the assembly of our new all-task force fighter, multi-task force fighter, what do you do with a NATO ally? And it's got 3 million immigrants that want to get into Europe, that it's getting $4 or $5 billion a year in bribe money to keep in Turkey. It's got about 70 overflights a month into Greek airspace. And there's all this energy problems with Cyprus. And the main problem is that Europe didn't want it in NATO. And now if you listen to most Europeans, they don't want Turkey. I mean, excuse me, they didn't want it in the European Union. I don't think they want it in NATO anymore. It's the only Muslim country. It's the only non-democratic country. Erdogan has really needled the Europeans with this immigration stuff. And I see that as a really big problem. The only good thing is that everybody hates Erdogan. So we've got Greece now is pro-American, and Greece is working with Israel. And there's some leverage there, but I don't see what you do with Turkey. It's going to be very dangerous, especially if they start feeding to the Russians all of the metrics and data of the new F-35 to how to shoot it down. And they start releasing more immigrants into Europe. They start claiming Samos or Lesbos as one of their islands they've talked about. It's just not a good idea to have that large, second largest army in NATO that's an Islamicist country and a crazy dictator. And remember, Obama said that he was our key to the Middle East, that he was our friend, and that's why we backed Morsi in Egypt. So I just don't think it's a tenable situation, and we're not looking realistically about it. Everybody says, well, it's got this base at on the Syrian borders, Incirlik. Yeah, but, I mean, when they had that supposed coup, they cut off all the power to the base, and they went into American areas within that base to extract Turkish generals who were seeking sanctuary. In 73 and 4, when I was living in Greece, as I remember, they warned the Americans to get out, and they got out, and they said, if you try to take your nuclear weapons with you, you're not going to be able to do it. And so it's not a good situation.
And I'm sure one that we'll probably be talking about more in the future. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.